Aloha, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Welcome to The Body Show. Each week we talk about health and fitness, but none of what we discuss replaces a visit to your own primary care provider. Today we're going to be talking about what to some is still a very controversial issue out there called medical aid in dying. Yesterday in the advertiser, the Star Advertiser, there is a wonderful balance of opinions with both those who are for this and those who may be against this. Today we are happily joined by Mary Steiner. She is one of the representatives who is a campaign manager for Compassion and Choices Hawaii. And we're going to talk today about some of the issues that relate to the bills currently in the legislature. There's Senate Bill 1129, there is House Bill 201, House Bill 550, House Bill 150, Senate Bill 357. Lots of movement in the legislature, and just last week, this particular Senate bill was pushed forward. It's going to have an opportunity for a hearing. So to tell us a little bit more about what this means to the people of Hawaii and why this may be following what their wishes are, we have Mary Steiner. Welcome to The Body Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm really excited to be here to talk about medical aid in dying.
So let's define it first, because there's a couple of different terms that float around. There is physician-assisted suicide. There is a variety of different terms that are out there. End-of-life care. Death with dignity.
Death with dignity is another one.
What would be the most accurate way to describe it?
Medical aid in dying is the most accurate way to describe it. That's when a physician provides a prescription to a person who is terminally ill with 6 months or less to live, who wants to end their life peacefully, and they are able to do so by taking the medication.
So it kind of takes away from the word suicide, because that tends to have a fairly negative connotation.
It absolutely takes away from suicide. This is not suicide. People who are very ill do not want to die. They do not want to take their own lives. They instead want to live, but they can't because the illness has taken over.
Well, and I've always thought the term death with dignity is a little difficult, because it would suggest that any other death isn't dignified. And as a physician, I've certainly seen a lot of dignified end-of-life situations that really don't necessarily relate.
And, you know, I learned that by spending time talking to hospice folks who said they were a little insulted by the term death with dignity, because everybody does die with dignity in their eyes. This is to help ease people and hasten their death when their suffering becomes unbearable.
So let's talk about who it would apply for. Now, there are provisions that we look at, and we can look at other states that have already passed legislative actions to allow this to occur. Let's take a look at what we mean by terminal, and then I'm going to ask you a few questions about situations that could come up that I think people are concerned about from the other end of the spectrum. So let's talk a little bit about our definition of terminal.
6 months or less to live.
For any particular reason or any reason? Is it only cancer related?
No, it's not only cancer related. It's any illness that you may have, that a person may have. But in the eyes of the doctor who's really practiced at this, they understand that it's 6 months or less, and that's considered terminal.
And that would be the time, you know, the definition of being approved for hospice care would be having 6 months or less left to live. So when we make referrals to hospice, we actually, in effect, have already made a clinical decision that this is potentially someone who might not last more than 6 months. In fact, I think nationwide statistics, and certainly those in Hawaii, suggest that too often we wait too long to make hospice referrals, that it's often more appropriate to consider that even earlier in the course of an illness.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Statistics hold true on that.
So when we talk about that 6 months or less time frame or less, is it just one physician who is making this determination, or is it more than one?
No, actually, the bill that is moving through our legislature right now requires there be two doctors. You have your, generally it would be your primary care or your attending physician, and then there would be a second opinion who would take a look at all the records and decide that you are, that the original doctor is correct and that this person is terminally ill.
And that second doctor, would they be required to be part of the part of the attending team of the patient, or would they be someone separate that would review the record, or have we not yet defined that?
I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Okay, because it may not be defined. All right. So let's talk a little bit about another key piece of this, which states that someone has to be able and of capacity to make their own medical decision.
That's absolutely one of the most important things. They must be mentally competent to make this decision, mentally capable.
So I've heard some folks say, what if, you know, there are adults who are taken care of, there are mentally challenged children, and they're worried if they pass on, would their mentally challenged children be forced to do this, or would they be able to make this decision if they currently don't have medical capacity? So if you don't have medical capacity yourself, not your guardian, but you yourself, you would not be able to utilize this.
You are not eligible for medical aid in dying unless you can make the decision yourself, and you also must be able to ingest the medicine yourself.
And there's another element of it. So you can't necessarily be someone who decides to do this on behalf of someone else. You know, one of the questions that would come up would be people who have dementia or Alzheimer's or some other advanced stage where their mental capacity is not intact. In that situation, they would not be eligible to utilize this.
No, sadly, they would not.
Which I think is one of the other concerns, is that often people are afraid that their elderly loved ones who would not be of capacity would be encouraged to do this. But there is a determination of capacity that puts a stop there. You can't go beyond that.
Right. I think that what happens is that you have relationships. We have relationships with our physicians, with our primary care doctors, and they know us better than anybody. And they know if we have capacity or we don't. And they're not. And part of what they have to do is to stop it if we are not capable.
Well, and there's actually medical definitions of capacity as well. So there are ways that primary care providers, geriatric specialists, psychiatrists, etc., there's actually a definition of what defines medical capacity. And therefore, that would be the determining element that you can't, that's like an end stop. If that doesn't occur and you don't have capacity, then you would not be able to be eligible for this.
Right. And I think that that's a general misunderstanding about the bill, is that anybody can get a prescription when in fact they can't. And there are stops, as you say, all along the way. And that's a big one. If you are not mentally capable, you cannot get a prescription.
Now, when we talk about the prescription, what is it for?
It's for a very fast-acting barbiturate that you take in along with a anti-nausea medication, because it's extremely bitter. So, and then you open up the capsules and you drop it into water or applesauce or something to help cut the bitterness, and you drink it.
So you'd also, as you mentioned earlier, have to be able to ingest it.
You have to be able to ingest it.
So this is different than someone who, you know, years ago, and I think this poor gentleman got a very bad reputation, et cetera, but Dr. Jack Kevorkian, when he actually was setting up some type of a system where it would be in an infusion, and then there was some way where the patient had to press a button or something. I mean, it got all sorts of logistically out of hand. In that case, it was a physician who was actually helping to administer. And what we're saying is this is self-administered.
Right. And what you're talking about, I believe, is euthanasia.
That would be another term.
When somebody actually does it and ends your life for you. That is not what we're talking about here.
Now, there's a lot of people who have concerns about it, and they have concerns that people who should not be able to employ this would be compelled to do so. They have concerns that people who don't have capacity, there are concerns about whether or not we know the medication is appropriate and it works. I think if you look at some of the information that comes out from using these medications, there really doesn't seem to be any question as to whether or not it works.
It seems to work. It does. Can I just say something, though, along with that, is that it's not, I would disagree that there are a lot of people that have concern, because when you look at the polling here in Hawaii, we did a poll, and 80% of people across the board, it didn't matter what religion they were, it didn't matter what ethnicity they were, it didn't matter what island they lived on, 80% were in favor of having this as an option at end of life. So that seems to be the case. It's not a lot of people, because it's certainly not even the majority that have concerns. The other thing that was interesting was that yesterday's Star Advertiser ran one of their little readers' polls, and that actually came out at 81%. So again, we're keeping at that 80% level, whether you have a subscription to do the Star Advertiser, or if you got a call, if you were one of 618 people that got a call from our pollsters.
I stand corrected. But I mean, I think it really does reflect the fact that, you know, originally when the poll came out, there's a question as to who were they asking, who was part of it. And now that we've seen other polls being taken, or we've seen information from the other citizens here in Hawaii who have answered these questions, who wanted to have their opinion known, you're right. We are hearing that 4 out of every 5, 80%, are suggesting this is something that they would agree with.
Right.
Now, we've talked a little bit about physicians being able to concur that this particular illness is something that would define their lifespan as 6 months or less. It wouldn't necessarily be any physician. I know in the editorial yesterday, one of the questions was, you know, would we allow ophthalmologists, or would we allow orthopedic surgeons or dermatologists to be making these decisions? They have MD after their name. Would someone who may not have the ability to determine that 6 months or less criteria be put in a position where they would have to?
I don't want to laugh at these kinds of questions that are put out there. But the idea, you're not going to go to an ophthalmologist if you are terminally ill.
And unless you have an eye disease. Okay, but other than that, okay.
Right. So you're just not. So the whole idea of having an ophthalmologist be making this primary decision about your life to help you with your and ease your life is just not going to happen. I think that they're just grasping at straws to come up with reasons why this is not a good idea. And I totally disagree.
Now, there are quite a few physicians who feel as though this is not something they feel comfortable with. This bill does not require all physicians to participate.
No, the bill doesn't require all physicians to participate. And in fact, the Hawaii Medical Association just made a decision to go neutral, meaning that they're not in favor, but they're not opposed either. And they used to be opposed to this. The AMA is looking at it now and will also be coming up with a decision, going through their decision-making process. And they may come out with a really major decision. We don't know yet.
Well, and the idea of being neutral is to sort of leave that decision up to the individual physician.
That's...
Now, how do they run it in Oregon? Are you familiar with how they do that?
Oregon's been working for almost 20 years, and there has not been a single case of abuse in 20 years of working. They do reporting every year. They put out the reports. In fact, the 2016 report should be out momentarily. And what those reports show are the number of people that have asked for prescriptions, the number of people that ingest the medication, which is way fewer than the prescriptions written, and the underlying diseases that people had.
So looking at this statistically, when you think about the numbers of people that die in Oregon per year, the numbers of those people who might request a prescription, and then from that, the numbers that actually use it, we're talking about extremely small numbers of people.
Extremely small numbers of people. I think that the article in the paper yesterday referred to 40 people would probably use it in a year. That's very tiny, given that about 11,000 die in Hawaii every year.
I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Mary Steiner. She is the campaign director here in Hawaii of Compassion with Choices. And when we come back, we are going to discuss further about some of the ways in which this legislative bill could change what physicians can do to help people in end-of-life care. We'll be right back.
Support for The Body Show comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, and we're here in the studio today talking with Mary Steiner, Campaign Manager of Compassion and Choices Hawaii, about some of the legislative bills that are currently in place that are looking at passing the potential for physicians to be able to participate in medical aid in dying. Now, quick before the break, we defined what we mean by that. That is the ability to legally write a prescription for someone who has a terminal illness, which is defined as someone who has 6 months or less to live, who is of medical capacity, meaning they can make a decision, who is physically able to ingest, meaning they would have to take this medication themselves, a prescription that would knowingly end their life. And there's been some question about whether or not this is something that people in Hawaii support. Most recent polls have suggested that 80% of residents of Hawaii have actually suggested this would be something that they would want to have as an option for end-of-life care. Now, before the break, we were talking about the numbers of people who actually have utilized this. In Oregon, there have been 1,545 lethal prescriptions written, resulting in 991, that's 64% of people who have chosen to use the medication. And in this particular situation, we're looking at whether or not this should be appropriate for Hawaii. Statistics in the paper yesterday said that if we were to consider, as Mary has mentioned, 11,000 people die in Hawaii each year, then based on the statistics of what would be potentially utilized in Oregon, we would be looking at a very small number of people in our population who might consider utilizing this. Now, Mary, again, I'm going to put you in a hot seat. Uh-huh. If you had a terminal illness and you had 6 months or left to live and you knew that this illness was going to result in some potentially uncomfortable, painful episode of end-of-life care, would you choose to utilize medical aid in dying?
I would never want to say now what I would do if I was in that situation.
Really? Because I would answer it right now, Mary. I would say if I was going to have a terminal horrible illness, yes, I would use medical aid in dying.
I would like to think that I would say that, but I've reached a point in my life where I would never say that for sure. I just don't know when I'm in that situation how I would feel. But I certainly would want to have the choice and the option to do it. And that's what we're talking about here. Not forcing people, not making them do it, but having the option.
Well, and that's a really good point, you know, because essentially what we're looking at is statistically maybe 30, 40, 50, maybe less than 100 people in Hawaii, based on statistics in Oregon, that would potentially utilize this. And we're not talking about large numbers. You know, and maybe I'm just young and I'm going to hold on to that. Maybe I'm just too young to know better because I like the thought that I'm young. Although I'm not, but I'll just take that. You know, when we think about end-of-life care, we have to consider that is it something that we should dictate to people, or should they be given a choice or an option? You know, the title of your organization, Compassion and Choices. The idea being that it is an option. It is not necessarily anything that is mandated.
We have all kinds of options here in Hawaii when we're ill. We can turn off a device that might save our lives. We can decide we don't want to have dialysis. There are all kinds of things that we can do. And this becomes another option that we should be able to have when we're talking to our physicians about what our end of our lives are going to be like.
Well, one of the things that I found very curious about Oregon, and I've looked at it fairly carefully for a variety of reasons, but one of the curiosities I found is that, in fact, when they looked statistically, when they looked at it, they noted that 91% of people who utilized this option were actually enrolled in hospice care.
We would recommend that everybody be enrolled in hospice care. Hospice is amazing, and it's really helpful and an important help when you're dying. There's no doubt about it. But sometimes it's just not enough for people, and they want to have that extra security. They want to perhaps relieve their own anxiety. They don't take the prescription, but having it can definitely relieve some of the anxiety that they go through.
Well, and I would agree that, you know, when we look at our hospice organizations in the state, they are all stellar. I think it takes a very special person to work in hospice. And every time I talk with those who do, I am always amazed and humbled at how compassionate they are, committed they are, and how, you know, I think about it when someone is going through this end-of-life situation and everyone else runs away because they're afraid, It's the hospice organizations that run to the individual and say, let me hold your hand. Let me help you. Let me do something to help alleviate your fear and your suffering. Should we wait when people have a terminal illness for them to have pain in order to get pain relief?
No, I don't think that we have to wait. I think that if they are terminally ill, again, having the prescription is what can help relieve that anxiety. And some people don't have pain until the very end, and that's fabulous for them. But other people suffer extreme pain.
So one of the comments that I've heard made is that medical aid in dying allows the patient to take control of the situation, as opposed to waiting for a physician, myself, who was participating in the hospice program, to authorize the use of medication to relieve pain.
This is definitely patient-centered care.
And as we are looking in throughout healthcare, throughout the nation, we're looking at patient-centered medical home. We're looking at accountable care organizations, terms that are trying to focus the idea of healthcare back to the individual, to let them make their own choices. For someone who would be afraid that allowing this choice would be something they don't believe in, no one has to participate in this.
Nobody has to participate. Nobody's forcing an individual to get a prescription or take medication. That is not what this is about.
So this is adding an option without subtracting from any of the other benefits that are currently in place.
Exactly.
So what if it doesn't pass?
If this particular Senate bill does not pass, we will try again next year.
Continue to try.
We will continue
to try and try again
to make it happen. In the meantime, there is a lawsuit that my organization has brought forward on behalf of a terminally ill individual and his doctor who would like to write him a prescription but cannot because we're not positive where the law stands. We're looking for clarity. And perhaps what we're saying is it would be great to help this man right now. It's really important. He needs it now. But if we can't through legislation, perhaps then we will through the lawsuit and do it legally.
And in that situation, I think you're referring to the case that's currently going on. And I do believe, is it Chuck Miller who's involved in that?
Yeah, Dr. Miller is the physician.
He's the physician. And the patient?
John Radcliffe.
Very well-known lobbyist, to my knowledge.
Yes.
And he's, you know, one thing to say, if you are looking at the end of life and you are still trying really hard to change legislation, I mean, he's spending his time, the limited time that he has, really focus on trying to bring this forward and hopefully help to succeed.
He's an amazing man because he's using all of his energy that he possibly can. And I know it's really hard for him, and he gets really tired, yet he comes out to all of our events. He speaks at forums, and he's been on TV and everything else. He's just incredible. He is so committed.
Are there any other myths that you think, or misperceptions, or thoughts that are just incorrect that you've heard about that people have argued against this concept as a result of?
Traditionally, one of our opponents has been the disabled community. People with disabilities, I think there's a fear that somehow they are going to be forced into taking medication. And that, again, disabled people are not terminally ill, and therefore they do not qualify for medical aid in dying. That's it. And if you look at the legislation, that's how it is.
If someone were to be disabled and also have a terminal illness and have
Absolutely.
Mental capacity, that would be treated the same as anyone else in that situation.
Exactly. Then they would. But otherwise, just by virtue of being disabled, they would not.
So that would be one of the fears that have come up.
That has come up, and it comes up often.
Do you think there would be enough physicians who would want to participate in a program like this?
I think that the physicians would participate once the fear of going to jail
Yeah, that's
taken
a pretty
away.
Big fear, I got to tell you. I've seen it on TV, and it's nothing like that in real life, I'm certain, nor did it look that good on television.
Right. Yeah, or you don't want to have your medical license revoked. So therefore, I think once that's taken away and once there's some instruction on implementing the new law, I think there will be some physicians who participate, and I think there'll be some who don't.
So it's really allowing the flexibility of the physician to decide if they're going to participate or not. It also allows the patient to decide if they want to participate or not. And it's adding an extra choice without detracting from anything currently present.
Exactly.
I can see why 80% of people have thought this would be something they're supporting.
It makes sense. It makes complete sense. All of us, what we'd say is we're all one bad death away from being a supporter of medical aid in dying. If you've lived through a bad death with a relative or a loved one, family member, friend, you see what it's like, you suddenly come out and support this practice.
Well, and I don't want to have anyone else have to suffer being the person who has the bad death or being someone who has to witness this. I think the key that I can tell from the argument to support this, of which, you know, full disclaimer, I think it's already known. I've said I would use it, Mary. I think I'm a supporter, is that it really is just adding an extra choice. It almost doesn't make sense to me that we would restrict the choice because of our personal or religious beliefs, that in fact, if we step away from this and they say separation of church and state, if you just look at this purely as an aspect of what could be offered as a choice, it's different than what's going on in other countries. I mean, there are countries in Europe where there's no restriction on age and no restriction on diagnosis of terminal illness, and they have all of these very different policies. But what we're looking at is a strictly regulated, very specific opportunity that is being offered to people should they want it, to be given a medication that no one's even saying they have to take, should they choose to get the prescription and fill it and have it in their house. It sounds like it's something that we really have to take a very careful look at, and I personally hope that it passes.
I really hope it passes as well. I think that what happens is, at least for me, when you ask if I would take it or not, I would start with other kinds of medications, other ways, other treatments. And when those treatments no longer were working, then I might consider it as well.
All right. Well, it's certainly, you've stated your opinion and you've stated what you believe in. And certainly we know that this is something that could definitely be a huge factor as we look at the legislature. And it's not just the Senate bill. There's also companion bills in the House as well.
Yeah, but the House bills did not get hearings before the deadline.
So the only one still alive is Senate Bill
1129.
And you can find that on Hawaii.gov. You can take a look at the bill. You can read it. You can see what other sorts of questions that you might have are often answered in the wording of it. And there's a lot of opportunity for people to express their thoughts.
And if you have any questions, you can contact me.
All right, Mary, how do we do that?
M. Steiner, Steiner, at compassionandchoices.org.
And if you would like to send a message through the station, you can talk back at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks again for coming in today on a holiday, Mary, to share your thoughts with us and your expertise.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
If you'd like to hear this show again, you can click on our podcast, hawaiipublicradio.org. Follow the links to The Body Show. Our engineer is David Chong, our executive producer, Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, and we will see you right here next week when we talk about more health and fitness topics here on The Body Show. We'll see you then.